Glory Hole. Chapter 7. Don stepped into Christopher Enger's apartment for the first time in his life. He was not surprised at the lavish furnishings. After seeing Ed's home, he was beginning to expect the unexpected with these men. He wondered why he had been summoned there. Usually, when Ingers wanted a guy, he took them to his own office, sometimes using the privacy of a little closet which was conveniently located. Maybe Ingers wanted to enjoy him in comfort, he mused. Christopher greeted him warmly and asked him to be seated on a long white sofa. Would you like something to drink? No, thank you. Not at the moment. Well, how about some coffee? Christopher asked. Okay, I'll take coffee. Don smiled for the first time in some days. Inger went about perking the coffee in the kitchen. He talked about the weather and barely mentioned work, for which Don was grateful. Don noticed a baby grand piano in one corner of the room, and he walked over to it. There were several pictures in silver frames on the piano. He picked them up idly and looked at them. One was an extremely handsome man, somewhere in his early 30s, surrounded by three children and one attractive woman. He noticed the resemblance to Christopher Ingers immediately. The man might have been Ingers when he was younger. Ingers entered the living room with the coffee once more. I see you've discovered my family. When Don looked up, he continued, That's my son and my grandchildren. I'm rather proud of them. I thought he might be your son because of the resemblance, Don said, placing the picture back on the piano. I didn't even know you were married. Yes, a long time ago. My wife died when she was 30. She's been dead a long while. I never remarried, so I only have one son. He's a fine-looking man, Don commented. Come sit down and have some coffee. Ingers poured the coffee from the percolator. Don helped himself to cream, straight from the can, and he rather liked the lack of ostentation. Ingers could well afford to serve coffee more formally. I suppose you're wondering why I asked you to come here, Ingers said as he helped himself to sugar. Yes. The coffee was strong, stronger than he usually drank it, but he was not going to complain. Some of the men have noticed that you're acting, well, a bit strangely, Ingers commented. Don didn't know what to say. I'm not going to beat about the bush, Ingers said. I'm going to go straight to the heart of the matter, now that I've got you here. Don waited for the inevitable proposition. He had been told that Ingers usually helped himself to any of the men in the IC whenever he felt the urge. So far, he hadn't been approached, but he figured that this was the moment. You're in love with Ed Pfister, and it's tearing you to pieces, Ingers said. Don looked at the man and saw his eyes filled with sympathy. Christ, did everyone know? Did it show that bad? Yes, you're right. Ingers sighed and put down his coffee cup. Don, you seem to be a bright, congenial sort of young man. I'm going to talk to you like a father should. Aside from Ed Pfister and this emotional attachment which has sprung up, I don't think you're suited for this type of work. You should be doing something else. When Don started to protest, Ingers held up a hand. I know, it's easy. Of course, there are disadvantages. You're out in all kinds of weather, sometimes all hours of the night, and it's especially disagreeable to have to work on narcotics cases, which aren't half as interesting as hanging in the Harrington Park men's room or over at the Hoover. Don found himself grinning in spite of himself. The old guy sure knew the ropes about the job. You don't have to tell me anything, Ingers said. I've been in this game too long not to know from first-hand experience just how it is. Who do you think installed the mirror in the Hoover? Tinkerbell? Don laughed. I want to tell you a bit about myself, Don. It isn't something that I tell everyone. In fact, there's only been one other instance where I discussed this with anyone else, and that was 10 years ago when a similar situation developed between two of my men. Ingers lit a cigarette and offered one to the younger man. Don accepted, and Ingers lit both of them and then blew a cloud of blue smoke in his direction. Years ago, when I was a very young man, I won't tell you how old, for then you'll know my age, which is a secret. I had been mustered out of the army after World War I. I had no family. I got a job working as a mechanic in a garage, and one day I met this young lady who had had trouble with her car. Cars were a lot less complicated in those days. Compared to today, they were simple, almost like a child's toy. Yet few people could perform the necessary mechanical tasks. She was a pleasant girl, and soon I dated her. She had a family. I suppose her family attracted me almost as much as she did herself. We had family dinners together, and they invited me for the holidays. In those days, families were closely knit. They had fun together. After the meal, there usually was a round of singing around the piano. Leslie played piano very well. That baby grand there once belonged to her. Anyway, I suppose her family was everything I had missed in life, or seemed to be. Her father was a wonderful old German from the old country who had turned on the Kaiser and helped his country beat him. But there was still some anti-German feeling in town then, not enough to cause much trouble, but enough to make German Americans conscious of it. I had none of this prejudice, and I was warmly received. In time, the family just seemed to take it for granted that Leslie and I would be married, and I started taking it for granted as well. We were married 2 years after I first met her. It was a good marriage, right from the beginning. Leslie was the type who could allow a man to live his own life. A lot of women were capable of that in the old days, a holdover from the Victorian period when man's word was law. She never interfered. Our son was born in 26, and unfortunately little was known of cesarean births in those days. It was practiced, but not as extensively as today. Leslie's pelvis was too small for the baby. She died of peritonitis. For a while, Leslie's parents helped me to raise Jimmy. He was a good baby, but the death of their daughter took a heavy toll. A year later, her father died, broken-hearted. Leslie had a brother. His name was David, and he had worked on the police force for several years. A new organization, the Vice Squad, was being established, and David got me a job on it. We worked together. He was a likable fellow, very big, typically German, with blonde hair and blue eyes and the kind of cheeks which always had a blush to them. 2 years after the grandfather died, Jimmy's grandmother passed away. The family I had so cherished was gradually dwindling, but at least I had a son. I would always have some family, unless something happened to him. Naturally, this made me cherish my son even more, for I feared his dying. David and I worked closely together, and I think he felt sorry for me, being a widower with a son to support and little help. Jimmy and I finally found a small apartment next door to David's house, so that his wife could help to take care of Jimmy as he got a little older. When he started going to school, it wasn't so difficult, but before he reached the age of 5, it was. He had to be cared for all day long, and I couldn't afford a nanny for him. David fell into the habit of coming over to my apartment in the evenings for conversation. People talked in those days. There was no lack of communication. We discussed the homosexual problem, which seemed to be on the increase, even then. If it had ever reached today's proportions at that time, we'd have been shocked. We read a lot about it, borrowing such books as were available from the library, and even taking books home from the police station. We studied case histories. I don't really know what motivated our interest then, in the early days. Perhaps it was curiosity. Then David asked me if I'd ever had a homosexual experience. I admitted that I hadn't, and neither had he. We both wondered about fellatio and sodomy. We couldn't see what homosexuals saw in these practices. They seemed to be so foreign, yet there was always this curiosity. One night after work, it was very late, David asked me if I'd agreed to experiment with him. We did. I tried fellating him, and he fellated me, and although we were greatly aroused, we had yet to develop the intrinsic psychological makeup which is necessary to enjoyment of oral pleasures. We both agreed that we didn't particularly see anything exciting about active fellatio. Another night, I tried to penetrate David's anus. He cringed and said it hurt too much to stand it. Then he tried it on me. I put a pillow under my hips and prepared to take him while on my back. I was worried, for David's penis was very large and thick. In those days, men weren't circumcised as often as today. David had a lot of foreskin, which could be retracted, but I think it saved me a lot of pain. Once completely inserted, the foreskin prevented undue friction and pain. It worked in and out of its own sheath, more or less, massaging me deliciously without paining me. I needn't have to tell you that I found the sensation terrific. I loved it right from the first. At the time, I was still ignorant of many facets of my personality. I threw myself passionately into the act, begged David to fuck me. My own passion kindled his. I was a widower and had been without sex for a long while. The feel of warm flesh and pleasure overtook me. David got caught up in my own passion, and he fucked me like a rabbit. David and his wife had 6 children. He had forgotten the feeling of a tight sheath around his penis. He naturally quite favored my tight anus, and soon he was fucking me twice a week. I'd put Jimmy to bed early, and then his uncle David and I would make love. I fell madly in love with my brother-in-law. I realized then that part of the attraction I'd felt for Leslie was because of him. I had really been unconsciously in love with David for a long time and hadn't known it. I told him about it, and he agreed that he'd felt attracted to me. Ingers poured 2 more cups of coffee and lit another round of cigarettes. He noticed that Don's pants were swelled at the crotch. His words hadn't been lost. "Am I embarrassing you by being so frank?" he asked. "No, Don Flesh, not at all. I understand how you felt. I'm the same way." "I figured as much after your initiation. I watched your facial expressions when you were fucked. Well, to make a long story short, Dave and I fell more and more in love. Our sexual relations became more pleasing, more passionate. We began to enjoy orally stimulating each other, although David never did really get the enjoyment from passive sodomy that I did. But he could allow me to fuck him if I really wanted it. But I was more intent on having it the other way. I enjoyed that. Jimmy was growing. David's children were getting older. Some of them at the time were in high school. We needed more privacy. He couldn't leave his wife, even if he had wanted to, and neither of us wanted that. We couldn't continue as we had because of Jimmy's increasing awareness of the world around him. So we started meeting out, away from home. In the course of the years, I discovered another man on the force who was not unapproachable. David found still another, and we formed a club, the first IC in the country. Having 4 cut down the expense of meeting out, for we had to rent a room. It meant that I had to share David, a fact that I didn't like, but I found that as long as I was present whenever he had relations with another man, I didn't feel left out. There wasn't any jealousy unless he had relations without my knowledge or the presence at the time. The club began to grow. Soon, we had 6 members. I learned that, as some of our men moved to other parts of the country, the idea spread among our circle of employment. David, knowing of my anal interest, managed to fuck me several times a week at these get-togethers. We enjoyed having others watch our love-making. But then, David died when he was 46. Cancer. He was dead in 3 months after we discovered what was wrong with him. I was inconsolable. It was right after World War II. My son was in the army, and several of David's boys were also in the service. The funeral was a nightmare. I had to gird myself, but luckily, because of our relationship and the close bond which everyone knew existed between us, no one thought it odd that I was grief-stricken. Even our children understood, or thought they did anyway. Since that time, I've devoted myself to my job and the spread of other IC groups around the country. Whenever I remember how much David and I loved one another, it always helps me to carry on. "It sounds hypocritical, if you'll pardon me, sir," Don said, sipping his coffee. "If your love was so great, what possible satisfaction can you get from persecuting homosexuals, who are, after all, doing no more than what you and David did?" "That's just the point I'm trying to make, Don. You don't understand. You realize, of course, that such an organization as the Vice Squad will exist, whether you or I like it or not. Can you think of a better person to lead it than someone like myself? After all, we try not to push these cases into court. Most of them are really settled out of court anyway. If someone really vicious were at the head of it, our jails would be swelling with homosexuals. But why arrest them anyway? Do you realize the heartache and confusion that we cause?" Don asked. "Suppose someone had told your family or David's family what had been going on between you. That I wouldn't have liked. I don't like seeing these other homosexuals arrested, nor, as you said, having their families turn against them, but there are disadvantages to everything. I can't deny that it's impossible for me to create a utopia, but I'm trying. At least I can prevent things from getting worse." "That's about the most I can hope for, Don. It hurts me, but I can't be too brazen without it becoming suspect. As it is, I've managed to make the Hoover men's room free territory, so at least they have one place where they can have fun without fear of arrest and exposure. But, of course, the fact that they pay for this freedom means nothing. Do you realize who controls most of the gay world? If the bars aren't syndicate-operated, they are managed by ex-policemen, detectives, heterosexuals out to make a buck out of the gay guy. Can you think of a better person to make him pay through the nose? Don nodded. He was beginning to see a little of what the other man was trying to do. I found out early that the opportunists who make the vast fortunes off the gay set are invariably heterosexual. Homosexuals have a lot going against them. They would often find it difficult to get financial backing for a business venture of this sort. Most people consider them to be unstable and therefore poor risks. So, some heterosexual makes all the gravy. I guess it's just a turnabout. Either they cough up, or they can't operate. I haven't the slightest compunction about taking money from them. Understand that. It's not purely mercenary on my part, although I'll admit that some of the other men don't see it as I do. I even give a few large donations to some of the homosexual societies. All anonymously, of course. Then do you make a personal profit off it? Don asked. Yes, it is shared with the other men. How do you think Ed can afford to live as he does? In the future, you would be included, getting an equal fare of the share. I don't think I care for any, Don said, putting down his coffee cup. That's what I've been leading up to, Don. Inger smiled. I don't think you're cut out for it, young man. It takes a certain type. As for myself, well, even if I'm rationalizing, it does me psychological good to be in this position. I feel as though I'm getting revenge, right or wrong. The others, well, they have their own personal reasons. But I don't think you're like that, Don. If you don't mind my saying so, you're the type who should latch onto one man, live with him. The kind of man who will stick something up your ass 3 or 4 times a week and keep you satisfied. I know that all the meeting stimulated you, but I've watched you closely. It was wildly erotic, and you enjoyed it, but I don't think a steady diet will appeal to you. You really want one man. Unfortunately, the one you've decided upon is the wrong man for you.
Who can really decide that?
Don asked. I suppose Ed is best qualified, Inger said, and paused to light another cigarette. Did he tell you he's applied for a transfer to Chicago? Don's stomach hit the floor. Ed hadn't told him. It's true enough. Ingers blew out smoke. It seems that after 10 years of being our most amoral employee, Mr. Pfister has finally fallen hard for a blonde from Chicago. I believe you met him? Don licked his lips nervously.
Yes, I met him. His name is John Stansbury.
John and Ed, impossible, but he had seen the look in their eyes that night. They had met for the first time, and also, even then, Don had noticed Ed's attitude. It was possible for him to be infatuated. Ed didn't tell you, I suppose. Inger's mouth twitched. He's all wrong for you, Don. He might just be right for Stansbury, but not for you. Who knows, maybe it's one-sided. Maybe this Stansbury isn't as serious as Ed seems to think he is. In any case, it's a blind alley. Don didn't know what to do. He wasn't shocked about it, but he didn't know how to release the tension he felt inside. He couldn't cry like a woman or a child. Besides, he didn't feel like crying. Don, you and I have something in common. We've both lost a man we've loved very deeply. I'll admit that perhaps Ed doesn't deserve the feeling you have for him, but it was real and honest on your part, which doesn't change anything for me. You loved honestly. But admit that he's gone. Give him up. I had to learn to live without David. You can do it. You can live without Ed. What should I do? Find yourself another man. Give up this job, settle down, even if you have to move to another town. But do find yourself a man to live with, someone who deserves what you can give him. You can never live with yourself if you have to rationalize every day of your life, Don. You can't go on feeling that you're persecuting your fellows. That's the way it seems to you. If you could see it as I do, then perhaps there'd be a chance, but not with your present attitude. You're urging me to go gay all the way? Don asked. I'm telling you that because it's the only way for you. Then Don felt the older man's hands on his zipper. He was undoing it deftly. You just lie back, young man, Ingers whispered. Don didn't know what to do.
He wasn't in the mood for sex, although the man's conversation had aroused him earlier. He felt his belt buckle being undone, and he lifted his hips as anger slipped the trousers down to the level of his knees. Then he felt the wet mouth on his limp flesh moving open-mouthed over the underside of his cock, kissing his nuts and sucking on them. Don rested his hand on the arm of the sofa and looked at the picture of the piano while he was being fellated. The small group in the photograph looked upon the scene smilingly, and it almost amused Don. The mouth was gentle. Never once was there any suggestion of violence. It remained tender and loving, wetly adoring the youthful genitals. It took Don only 5 minutes to come. When he spurted, he found that it was taken in the same gentle manner, as though his fluid were being savored. The lips and tongue moved wetly about the spurting head until it ceased to throb. Then he was being gently engulfed, and the swallowing process began. The cock did not reappear until it was completely limp, and then it was licked clean of any saliva or white particles. "Lucky is the man who gets you," Ingers said, and helped him pull up his trousers.